It's Wednesday, September 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, President Trump defends his Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh.
He's an incredible individual, great intellect, great judge, impeccable history in every way.
Also ahead, China says it will retaliate against President Trump's increased tariffs on Chinese products. Syria aims at Israelis but shoots down a Russian plane. The cleanup continues after Hurricane Florence, and we'll hear about apps that help you communicate in a different language. That's all on today's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. We start now just up the street from our headquarters here at VOA on Capitol Hill, where a woman who accuses President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her 35 years ago when they were teenagers wants the FBI to investigate her allegations before she testifies to the Senate Judiciary Committee. In a letter to the committee chairman Chuck Grassley, the lady's lawyers said that she wants to cooperate, but in the days since making her accusation, she has been the target of harassment and even death threats. The committee had previously scheduled a hearing for Monday. Now, it is not clear if that hearing will be held. Speaking at the White House, President Donald Trump said he felt badly for Kavanaugh and wanted the process to end as soon as possible.
He's an incredible individual, great intellect, great judge, impeccable history in every way. I feel so badly for him that he's going through this, to be honest with you. I feel so badly for him. This is not a man that deserves this. This should have been brought to the fore. It should have been brought up long ago. And that's what you have hearings for. You don't wait till the hearing is over and then all of a sudden bring it up.
Trump expressed disappointment with opposition Democrats for sitting on the information, especially mentioning Senator Dianne Feinstein, who had met with Kavanaugh for quite a bit of time and did not bring up the allegation. Kavanaugh said he had no idea who was making this accusation until Christine Blasey Ford, a Stanford University professor, alleged in a Washington Post interview published Sunday that Kavanaugh and a friend, who were both stumbling drunk, had cornered her in a bedroom at a house party in suburban Washington and that Kavanaugh had groped her. The federal circuit judge declared he had never done anything like what the accuser describes. On Capitol Hill Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Democrats are acting in bad faith.
The blatant malpractice demonstrated by our colleagues across the aisle will not stop the Senate from moving forward in a responsible manner.
Meanwhile, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said the Senate should make every effort to make sure the process is thorough and correct.
Let's call all of the relevant witnesses, not just two selected by Chairman Grassley, who didn't want to call the hearings to begin with. Let's do this fair and full and right.
Alaska Republican Senator, or Maine Republican Senator, that is, Susan Collins, considered to be a key vote if Kavanaugh is to be confirmed, says she hopes all parties get a chance to testify to the committee under oath.
We'll see what happens, but the important thing is that both Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh be given the opportunity to come before the Judiciary Committee in a public session and testify under oath.
This dispute has many here in Washington thinking of the 1991 confirmation hearings for now Justice Clarence Thomas, who was accused of sexual harassment by a former co-worker and law professor, Anita Hill. Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington says she does not want to see Professor Ford treated the way that Hill was.
Committee members need to have the facts. That's why they're asking for an FBI background investigation, and I believe that that would produce a much better hearing. It's serious, and I hope all the members of the committee take this seriously and do this in the right way, because it wasn't done in the right way with Anita Hill, and we had a generation of women who said it's not worth it coming forward. I do not want that to be this message today.
Republicans have been pushing to confirm Kavanaugh before November's midterm elections, when they could lose their slim majority in the Senate. Among the other top stories in the world, Trump hints of more declassifications in Russia probe. ICC opens preliminary probe into Rohingya expulsions. UN chief welcomes de-escalation in Syria's Idlib. Hungary's Orban warms to Putin over nuclear deal. And U.S. unveils new biodefense strategy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. China says it has no choice but to retaliate against U.S. President Donald Trump's 10% tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. That risks a further escalation of trade tensions between the world's two largest economies. On Tuesday, China announced a tariff hike on $60 billion worth of American products. The $200 billion in U.S. tariffs go into effect Monday, leaving the two sides little time to negotiate. Earlier this week, President Trump warned that if China retaliated against U.S. farmers or other industries, Washington will immediately pursue Phase 3, which is tariffs on approximately $276 billion more additional imports. Tuesday, the president repeated his assertion that China has taken advantage of the United States.
Because we can't let them do anymore what they've done. And I watch trade deficits because to me, deficits are very important. They're not everything and they're not exact. Sometimes you can have a deficit and that's not such a bad thing. But when you have $375 billion in trade deficits and then many billions of dollars in other liabilities of all different types, you have to do something about it.
For some perspective, VOA's Ira Melman asked Alan Sykes, a professor of law at the Stanford University Law School and a leading expert on international economic relations, what the latest moves mean for the world's two largest economies.
I think that there's a strong amount of pressure on both countries to bring this to an amicable conclusion. It's not going to help either economy. China is relatively weaker than we are right now, but it will begin to take its toll on the United States, one suspects, fairly soon. So, meetings next week are a good sign. Whether there will be an atmosphere where something can actually get accomplished, I don't know. I don't have any prediction for how this will turn out.
Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for such a meeting?
Well, certainly China could make some concessions on things. The president has never been terribly specific about exactly what he wants China to do, which is it's harmful in one sense because it's not clear what he would accept as a satisfactory resolution. On the other hand, it gives enormous flexibility to both sides to settle on relatively modest concessions and declare victory.
Where do you stand on tariffs?
Well, I think certainly tariffs over the long term are harmful to the world economy. They reduce productive efficiency. They reduce global income. An ideal world would be a world without tariffs. But at the same time, one can make an argument that if you could negotiate a better outcome through the use of temporary tariffs to gain negotiating leverage, and if you could use tariffs to get better protection for U.S. intellectual property, for example, it's conceivable that the tariff policy might actually work out to the benefit of the United States in the long run. But it all depends on how the negotiation plays out. My crystal ball is in the shop. I just don't know what's going to happen.
How much is this hurting and how much could it hurt U.S. consumers, U.S. farmers, anyone else who might be affected by these tariffs?
I can't give you quantitative figures in response to your question, but certainly as the scope of the tariffs broadens, more and more U.S. buyers of Chinese goods are going to be affected. And as the tariff rates rise from the initial 10% to 25% and so forth, the pain will increase as well. Certainly we're having this latest round involves more consumer products, more important industrial products. And China has threatened to potentially try and cut off some exports of things to the United States that are really an essential part of our supply chain. So it's just it's possible that it could become quite painful.
Alan Sykes is a professor of law at the Stanford University Law School, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling the shooting down of a Russian military plane by Syria a chain of accidental circumstances, tamping down what could have turned into a tense situation with Israel. 15 people aboard the Russian reconnaissance jet died when the Syrians shot it down, responding to an Israeli missile strike. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu told his Israeli counterpart Avigdor Lieberman that Israel bears full responsibility and Russia has the right to retaliate. But Putin stepped in, calling it a chain of tragic accidental circumstances. He said Russia would respond by taking additional steps to protect our servicemen and assets in Syria. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed his sorrow at the loss of Russian lives and blamed Syria for the incident. The Israeli military said its jets were targeting a Syrian military facility that supplies arms to the Iranian-backed terror group Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, told the UN Security Council that all parties need to refrain from further escalation of the conflict.
We call upon all parties, especially when we are getting this type of positive news regarding what could have been a dramatic military escalation, to refrain from military actions elsewhere that would only exacerbate an already complex situation. But for now, we are pleased that there is the escalation in one major area, Idlib.
President Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan agreed Monday to create a 15 to 20 kilometer demilitarized zone inside what is already a de-escalation zone in Idlib. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed the move, calling on all parties in Syria to cooperate in the implementation of the agreement and ensure safe and unimpeded humanitarian access in all areas, that is, through the most direct routes. The United Nations has been sounding the alarm bell on Idlib for several weeks, warning of a humanitarian catastrophe if the Syrian government followed through on its plans to clear the last rebel stronghold. The UN estimates that about 15,000 Islamic radical fighters are mixed in amongst the civilian population. On Tuesday, the UN humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock questioned whether the proposed demilitarized zone would hold.
What do we think the 3 million civilians, including those million children kettled in Idlib, make of yesterday's agreement? Well, they have a simple question. Is this merely a stay of execution? Or is it the beginning of a reprieve, the first tiny glint of light at the end of the very darkest tunnel?
The newly appointed U.S. Special Representative for Syria Engagement, Ambassador James Jeffrey, called on all parties in Syria to commit to a lasting ceasefire and to take immediate steps to advance the peace process. He said Iran, a key ally of the Assad regime, should leave Syria as part of the de-escalation, of hostilities.
Iran cannot dictate the future for the Syrian people. If Russia is interested in bringing peace to Syria, it should make sure Iran and its militias leave Syria once and for all. The risk of a broader conflict will leave with them.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey make up the group referred to as the Astana Guarantors. They originally oversaw 4 de-escalation zones in Syria. Idlib is the last one. The European Union summit on migration gets underway later today in the Austrian city of Salzburg. Brussels wants to deploy EU border guards across the external borders. However, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, frontline countries like Hungary want to police their own borders.
Sixty African migrants were plucked from the Mediterranean moments before their inflatable boat sank beneath the waves in a perilous rescue Saturday by Spanish authorities. It is the latest of dozens of such operations this year on the so-called Western Mediterranean route, which now accounts for more than half of all illegal crossings into the European Union. Most of the migrants are from Guinea, Mali and Morocco. Overall, migrant numbers into Europe are down 40% year on year, but migration continues to dominate EU policy debate. Visiting Paris before Wednesday's Salzburg summit, host Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz Monday called for an enhanced role for the EU border agency Frontex across the bloc's external frontiers.
To secure our external borders, the frontline countries of the European Union need our support, they need our solidarity, but on the other hand, they also have to accept the support and the help of the European Union.
That was a thinly veiled message for frontline states, including Italy and Hungary, whose governments have repeatedly blamed the European Union for the migrant crisis. Speaking to lawmakers Monday, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán offered a blunt response.
Határvédelemhez jobban értünk, mint bárki Brüsszelben.
He says Hungary is better at border protection than anyone else in Brussels or some international organization. Therefore, Hungary will not give up the right to protect its borders. Even within Europe's political alliances on the right and left, there are growing divisions over migration, says analyst Leopold Traugott of policy analyst group Open Europe.
The summit will most likely again be portrayed as the battle between, on the one hand, the progressives who want to keep Europe open, who want to continue to help asylum seekers, and on the other hand, the hardliners, the populists who want to close Europe down and create a fortress Europe. But in the end, the division isn't that clear-cut.
At London's insistence, Britain's exit from the European Union, just 6 months away, will also be discussed. The International Monetary Fund warned Monday that failure to strike an exit deal would entail, in its words, substantial costs for Britain's economy. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
President Donald Trump plans to visit North Carolina later today to see the destruction left behind by Hurricane Florence and the difficult relief efforts. Trump tweeted on Tuesday, "Everybody is saying what a great job we are doing with Hurricane Florence, and they are 100% right." Meanwhile, North Carolina officials say even though the sun was shining in parts of the state Tuesday, major flooding was continuing and is expected to worsen in some areas. Governor Roy Cooper says 16 rivers are at major flood stage, with an additional 3 forecast to peak either today or Thursday.
Even though there's no substantial rain now in the forecast and the sun may be shining, rivers continue to rise and we will see more flooding. Currently, there are 16 rivers at major flood stage, with an additional 3 forecast to peak at major flood stage tomorrow and Thursday. I can't stress enough, never drive through floodwaters. Don't drive around barricades. And if you're told to evacuate by local officials, please do so quickly. It could save your life.
About 10,000 people are in shelters across the state, and around 343,000 are without power. Cooper says that first responders have reported rescuing and evacuating more than 2,200 people and about 575 animals. More than 1,100 roads are closed across North Carolina. The state's two major interstates, I-40 and I-95, are closed in many locations. Cooper says that rising waters continue to make travel hazardous, and he urged residents not to try to get back to their homes.
While road conditions are starting to improve in some parts of our state, Rising creeks, streams, and rivers continue to make travel unsafe in many areas of our state.
As the floodwaters begin to recede, some people are going back to their homes to see what, if anything, is left. Michael White surveyed the damage at his home on Wardola Street in Jacksonville, North Carolina, where chest-high waters had flooded his home. A large tree fell straight through the trailer, ripping holes through the roof. White told the Associated Press that he spent Monday night inside the crushed trailer because of the memories made there.
Everything happens for a reason. So if it's God's will for me to go through this and actually for me to get it from the mud, literally, and to come up on my feet, man, and I'm all for it. I just don't understand.
White said that even if he were to rebuild, his home would never be the same.
You can't replace this. You know what I mean? It's too much love, too much years, too much blood, sweat, tears, too much happened. Family love was surrounded in this home. So even if the FEMA or whoever tears it down and builds another one, it's still not going to be this. It'll just be a house.
Meanwhile, in Wilmington, North Carolina, residents lined up by the hundreds Tuesday for free food, water, and tarps as officials struggled to open new routes to one of the state's largest cities. Workers began handing out supplies using a system that resembled a fast food restaurant drive-through. Drivers would pull up to pallets lining a street, place an order, and then leave without having to get out. Lieutenant Mary Beth Slocum is with the Virginia Civil Air Patrol.
We are giving them MREs, which are meals ready to eat. They're military-grade meal packets. And each meal packet has a significant number of calories, significant number of nutrition, and they can be prepared and heated up just with water. So it's a complete meal kits, and then also each person gets a case of water.
Wilmington remains virtually cut off from the rest of the state because of high water. Tony Karen, a resident of Wilmington, says everything he had in his house went bad.
Get relief from the stuff that we lost during the storm, which was pretty bad. A roof, you know what I'm saying, had holes in it, the water and everywhere. The water went bad. The food went bad in the refrigerator and the deep freezer.
Officials have said they will open roads as flooding recedes and downed trees and power lines are cleared away. It's not clear when that might be. Daryl Washington, another Wilmington resident, says the pallets of food and water offer a small amount of comfort in the midst of a difficult situation.
I need water, and my electric is still out. Electricity is still out in certain areas here in Wilmington, so I'm still waiting for them to come on, come back on. So right now, had to come get me some water. Because I'm doing. By the grace of God, I'm thankful.
Items have been brought into the city by big military trucks and helicopters, which have also been used to pluck hundreds of desperate people from atop homes and other structures. At least 36 deaths have been attributed to the storm, and officials say recovery will take months, if not years. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts. Every hour, on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Blighted areas of the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, often became places where drug deals or other crimes took place. But now, thanks to the efforts of Keith Green, those areas are being transformed into beautiful green spaces. As VOA's Steve Barragona tells us, the changes are helping even the mental health of the people who live there.
About 40,000 vacant lots litter Philadelphia's neighborhoods. Each one is a magnet for crimes big and small, says Keith Green with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society.
It sets itself up for dumping like this. It's really not safe for the kids that live around here because, you know, it's an open lot. Anybody can hide in here. You can stash drugs in here.
Emergency room doctor Gina South says she started treating people from these drug and crime-infested neighborhoods during her training at the University of Pennsylvania.
We took care of a lot of shooting victims and did a great job of treating their physical injuries, but did little to nothing to think about what was causing them to come in as shooting victims to us in the first place.
South's research found the environment of these blighted neighborhoods was affecting the mental health of the people who lived there.
They felt stigmatized and neglected, and then experienced a lot of negative emotions like depression and anxiety and fear.
South wondered what changing their environment might do. She started looking at the program Keith Green directs, called Philadelphia Land Care. Green hires local landscapers to clear the trash and weeds from vacant lots, replace them with trees and grass, mow them twice a month, and surround them with fences with openings that invite people in.
What we found was a significant drop in heart rate when people were walking past the vacant lots when they were greened compared to before they were greened.
Her group also found rates of depression dropped by about 40% around the lots that had been cleaned and greened. Crime went down, too, by 10% or more.
And our results were most prominent, actually, in the poorest neighborhoods in the city, so indicating that there may be certain neighborhoods where interventions like this can have the biggest impact.
Longtime resident Sheila Parker says the change has made a big difference for people's mental health.
People, you know, they go out their door and they just see rubbish and trash and nothing cut. It does a lot to a person. I know this has really been helpful for me. Really has.
Yes.
Green saw how his program was changing neighborhoods. He says people use what were once blighted lots as parks, gardens, and barbecue spots.
I saw that, but then when you start to throw these numbers like, you know, gun violence is going down and, you know, people's heart rates is being reduced. People are exercising more in certain sections of, you know, Philadelphia. You just be like, wow.
Green says he gets calls from officials around the country and around the world asking how a little green space can help revive their neighborhoods. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Philadelphia.
There's an age-old problem. What do you do when you go to a country where you don't speak the language? Michelle Quinn says an app might be your answer.
Travelers around the world know that being understood in a foreign country can be daunting.
It's scary because you don't know. You feel lost, right?
You feel lonely because it's your hard time connecting with people, and you feel kind of bad for not speaking the language.
But for consumers, this is the golden age of translation. Companies like Google are applying the latest in artificial intelligence to translation apps. Some work offline, so travelers can use them anywhere. At this technology store in San Francisco, the hottest selling item is a little handheld gadget that uses voice recognition to provide one-way translation in English, Spanish, Japanese, and Mandarin. It's called the Illy.
Hello and welcome to the store. So it's translating into Japanese right now?
Just under $200, the Illy has been snapped up by people who want a quick way to be understood. One of them is Greg McDonald, who travels to Japan several times a year.
I feel like I could go to Japan with this and ask anything, anywhere.
Mai Akiyoshi, with a Japanese company that makes the Illy, tried it out in San Francisco.
I can't speak English.
I would like to rent a bicycle.
So we have this bikes, our tandems, and our electric bikes.
Scott? But the Illy struggled a bit.
Can I rent what kind of cycling?
Sorry? Deep conversation may still be far off for the Illy or translation apps. But for those key questions in a foreign city...
Is there a restroom around here?
Yeah, I think there's one that way.
They can help get the answers. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Thanks for listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks also to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm David Byrd in Washington.